Welcome to MSP 1337. I'm your host, Chris Johnson, a show dedicated to cybersecurity challenges, solutions, a journey together, not alone. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of MSP 1337. It is coming out on time this week. Yay. So, Jim, with Kinetic Technology Group, Jim, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
I think you're probably pretty much everybody knows at this point that you're on like the monthly rotation to get at least one episode in. We're going to have to start calling this the Chris and Jim, also fireside chat. But part of the reason I've targeted you to be on the show is you've been heavily involved in the Trustmark and pursuing CIS controls. And when I look back on a lot of the episodes, they've often, I don't want to say a bit we're attached to, but they've followed kind of the pattern of like a CIS control or a safeguard that's come up. I mean, we've even had an episode, I don't know that you were on it, but we talked just about MFA and what it means and why it's important to talk about that. What does it mean to have centralized management of accounts? And so as you're getting ready for your assessment or going through the assessment for the Trustmark, and one of the things that, you know, comes up for everybody that's going through it is, how much evidence do I need? What kind of evidence are they looking for? How specific? How vague? I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And I don't want to say that it's exhausting, the questions. I think it's actually quite the opposite. It's actually refreshing to know that everybody is going through, whether it's the Trustmark or the CIS framework or any framework for that matter, is it's not easy. And there are things that you are going to find that you don't know how to collect the evidence for, or you're not sure what evidence would look like. But I wanted to talk about it more from the perspective of, yes, we can collect evidence, but why are we doing that? What's important? Forget the Trustmark for a second and like getting a badge, but like, Jim, walk me through what got you on sort of the bandwagon of doing any framework or following any sort of rules that said, I want to have somebody assess whether or not we're doing this right.
Well, I can tell you from my side of things that it was a lack of discipline that I knew existed in my own routine. Okay. And I still see it, you know, in every, you know, in our, you know, secure outcomes within our peer group, and, you know, just people that aren't, you know, I don't have time, or I, you know, and it's just like, I get honestly sick of hearing that, because it's like, look, you've got time to do all these other things. And, you know, just the couple of hours just to go down and give yourself a reality check of what you are and aren't doing, it's not that much time. It's just to start, right? Just to start and say, yes, we're doing this, whether or not you can prove it or not, but at least in your mind, you're like, okay, we're doing now. I need to go back and start doing these things. So for me, it was a lack of discipline and needing to be held accountable to something, right? It started with you know, a peer group member that was wanting the same thing, wanting to get with a group outside of peer group and with a group of people that were striving to enhance and build upon their maturity from a cybersecurity perspective. And then I kind of went off the grid a little bit because, you know, I'm like, well, this is cool, but I really feel like I need to attach a dollar sign to this thing before it really kicks me in the rear. So, we partnered up with a group that were doing, SOC 2 assessments. And they it wasn't really, their framework wasn't necessarily, built on one specific, whether it's CIS or NIST or anything like that. It was just kind of a general thing. I mean, the SOC 2 assessment, you know, assesses you on certain areas, but within that, you had to meet certain safeguards as well from a technology perspective. So that was kind of the deal that got me rolling. It was really knowing myself, a lack of discipline, not, you know, the time thing, and really just dedicating it and realizing that if I didn't change, that the likelihood of my company actually making it through, the next 10 years or whatever was gonna be pretty small.
So that raises a question. So you've been doing this now for, well, you've been engaged in a process of aligning with a framework that it goes back now, what, probably 3 or 4 years, if not
Yeah,
longer.
we're starting kind of like our fifth year in the process. Yeah.
So I get the whole accountability part, and I think that's kind of a great for those listening. Like, hey, if you don't have an accountability in place, whether it's through a peer group or you committed the money to do a trust mark or something along those lines, it starts to, if dollars are attached to it, it tends to have a little bit more of a stickiness of I should probably get this done. There's a value proposition, at least, even if it's not a big one. Did you find that the company as a whole at the beginning were they really resistant to this and not wanting to get on board, or was it kind of a collective, like everybody's kind of recognizing, like, hey, we've got to do something more than we are today?
So initially I had to get some people that were leaders within my company on board. I had just hired a finance person. And then I had my director of technology and service delivery, as well at the time.
Sure.
And I did have to, I mean, initially I just had to tell them I just was flat out point blank, I believe that if we don't take this seriously, that the longevity of this company as it stands, is probably pretty short. And going back to the whatever they call it, the 80-20 rule, and
Yeah.
whatever the name they give that,
The 80-20 principle.
right, the 80-20 principle. I wanted to be the 20% of
Yeah.
people in our industry that were moving in that direction and kind of leading the charge. And so, I mean, we're a small company and we're 13 employees. When we started this, we were probably 9 employees, right?
Yeah.
And so initially, the selling it to those two people was pretty easy because they both were like, well, we love this company and we want to see it, go beyond you someday when you retire or whatever.
Man, no one
And
in my group
so
ever retires. Come on, let's be honest. And so that, and then fast forward. So here we are today. You're being assessed for the trust mark. And along this way, did you see a shift? Because one of the things that kind of I've been thinking about, and one of the reasons why I thought it'd be good to talk to you, knowing that we've had some evidence conversations around what you're working on for the trust mark, but it got me
Right.
thinking about things like outside of, say, the scope that is the trust mark safeguards, and thinking about things that are more, I don't want to say generic, but like, hey, I have a service ticket. I put my time in, but there's no notes. Like, where's my notes? Like, why did you not put notes in? Oh, I was busy. And it's like, okay, well, what's the ramifications? And so I guess I was drawing these parallels between if you're running an MSP and you're taking seriously the services that you deliver both internally and to your clients, why would this really be all that different? It's just a different ask, right? Like, I think to some extent the reporting might look different, the type of information being tracked might be different, but as far as employees and the human element here, I would think it's the same. Like, it's not, this shouldn't be new hat.
Well, from my experience with the conversations that I've had with a number of other MSP owners, if you're struggling in the service delivery category, you will struggle in,
Yeah.
meeting a framework. And so, and this kind
There
of
is a
goes back.
maturity element here that has to be considered.
Absolutely. So, I mean, 10 years ago is when I really realized that we were not that operationally mature. I mean, we had systems in place and we had, things of that nature. But, ultimately, I learned to follow the principle of if it's not written down,
Right.
it's not a process.
Right.
Okay.
That's a great way of saying it. So I think to what you just said, for your, if you're listening to this, I think a policy can be in your head. You can execute a process that's in your head and procedures in your head. But I would argue that anybody else in your organization, they can potentially understand the policy that's in your head. They are unlikely to follow the procedures the exact same way if it's just in your head.
It's very true. I mean, so from that, we learned a lot of things. I mean, initially it was a lot of hard work and a lot of micromanagement, which I don't like.
Micromanaging from a get it done standpoint.
I think so. Just, basically just following up and checking and making sure that things were being done from a, entering time on tickets, actually making it to where you can't close a ticket unless there's time entered and notes put in, and reviewing those things to make sure that they're being done properly, right? So
Which
now
so that wow,
no,
yeah.
I
Go
was
ahead.
just gonna say, I mean, now it's so ingrained. I mean, any habit that you develop, any skill that you're trying to learn, you put enough time into it, and all of a sudden it becomes more like a routine. It doesn't seem like it's a burden. And so, and the point of it is that yes, initially following a framework or doing any of that stuff is going to be a burden. It's going to encroach upon your personal time or the time that you think that you have to give someplace else. But once you start doing it, it does become like any other habit in developing, skills. I'm a guitar player. I mean, I didn't just pick it up and start playing. I had to dedicate time to do that. And I think that any of us that own businesses, particularly, the survival instinct needs to kick in a little bit here, because if you want to be at a certain level, operationally mature or security mature or anything else, it's going to take some dedication to do it.
So that kind of leads us into the sort of transition piece of as a solution provider, figuring out that if you don't have some maturity in place around service delivery, operations, that it's kind of hard to tackle cybersecurity or really any sort of defined set of safeguards, regardless of what they might be for. They could have a set of safeguards for, how to run your business. I mean, obviously, if you're organizationally not looking to improve that process, it's not going to really matter which one you tackle. So I think that makes it very clear, like, hey, get processes in place, get your procedures in place, make sure that everybody in your organization is kind of following that mindset. But then that gets us into this sort of like we've kind of skirted it, like talking about evidence for tickets. But talk to me a little bit about your process, leading up to having evidence for SOC 2 or the Trustmark. Like, I feel like that's a big shift in the type of evidence that you're now collecting. That's a little bit more, there's more effort involved in a lot of cases.
Sure. We were initially, it was so overwhelming, man. I think our first process really took about 9 months,
Oof.
right? I mean, from beginning to end, from the time I said we're going to do it and I wrote the check and signed the contract to go through the process. I mean, it took 9 months. And part of that was me. Part of it was my lack of wanting to delegate it, because I really wanted to absorb as much of it as I could. But I realized about 4.5 months into it that it's not something that I can do on my own, and that I really needed to start engaging the rest of my staff to do this. And so initially, when we did the SOC 2, it was a type 1. We never actually achieved the type 2, though we were prepared to do so, and then decided to move down the Trustmark route with CompTIA. But I think our I wish that evidence collection was a little bit more automated, and I think that's starting to show up a little bit more.
Sure.
But for us, it was certainly not. I mean, we were logging into 72 different platforms and showing evidence that we had MFA turned on. I
Right.
mean that I
Right.
mean
Definitely
that's a
not centrally managed, right? Like it's
right. Definitely was not centrally managed. I mean, a lot of that has changed in the last several years for us.
Didn't exist back in the day, right? Like, man, SSO, like we look at the SSO tax website, like, man, some of the websites are some of the vendors who have SSO now, like the cost is prohibitive for a lot of smaller businesses.
It still is. I
Yeah.
mean, it's like you have to go up to the enterprise level with a minimum of, say, a
500
50 user
seats
book,
or more. Yeah.
right,
50.
buy-in, and you're a company of, I mean, for us, 13, right, or whatever the case may be. So it is kind of ridiculous, and believe me, I've been making every single one of them that I encounter aware of my displeasure about that.
Right. And I mean, and I think it comes with some overhead costs that we have to also, I don't want to say appreciate, but we understand based on us going through the steps to secure, it's not so different. So talk to me a little bit about, you were mentioning some of the things that you had to do, MFA, show proof of that. How has that changed? Because one of the things that's really interesting about what you said about like, automated systems. Yes, technology is moving very rapidly. What was very manual 4 or 5 years ago, you can now do a lot of that data collection very fast, whether it's through a PSA or sorry, an RMM or some of those tools that can go and harvest. But I think we're still dealing with that 80-20 rule again, only this is where technology still has the limitations of what it can do from an automation standpoint. It still involves the human element. And I think sometimes we lose sight of tools being able to do all of it, and we get upset when it like it's only doing like this one small piece, and you're like, yeah, but that one small piece would take you hours if you had to do it manually. So like, take the wins where they are. So evidence collection today for you, how has that changed over the course of the last couple of years? Because I mean, evidence maybe was it lighter when you did it the first time, or what was it that they asked for that you thought in the beginning was like, I don't know how we're ever going to collect that evidence. And then today you're like, I'm collecting the evidence. I'm not necessarily writing it the way they want to read it, but we're doing the things we say we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, it was again back to the processes and everything that we really established during our first assessment. And so,
Got it.
and it just again, it became a routine. Like, we are not always collecting evidence, but we know where to get the evidence for what we need to do now. So, when we were getting ready to strive for the SOC 2 type 2, the whole deal there is to prove it over a
A period of
six
time.
to nine
Yeah.
month period of time, as opposed to a once one point in
Yeah,
time,
the
right?
snapshots, that's almost a, I don't want to say it's easier, but like you're only going to be in that spot in time one time anyway.
Right,
No
exactly.
matter what you do.
So, a lot of it was like, some of it, especially on the SOC 2 side, it's like, okay, well, we have meetings to review these things, right? And so we formulated templates, started using, 90 for
Yeah.
meeting documentation and minutes and things of that nature that, showed that, hey, we were reviewing these, and we would take screenshots of those reviews and collect them into a place and be done with that. And so that's how it kind of started. Now it's probably very similar to that.
Yeah.
I mean, things have changed somewhat. But when we do we do backup restore testing, not only for our organization, but for every client that we do backup routines for. So on a quarterly basis,
Sure.
we go in and do that. We track it, we document it, take the necessary steps.
Resilience, right? You're adding in, so it's to some extent the whole effort of collecting evidence from an assessment standpoint is really about being able to prove something right now. And where you're at in the path that you're on, correct me if I'm wrong here, is about being able to prove it at any given time because you've asked or you want to look at something and like, because if it fails, then it's failing for everybody.
Right, that's correct. So that's really the approach that I've tried to take. Look, I don't consider myself an assessor, but I tried to look at it from that mindset now,
Yeah.
particularly. It's like I'm constantly
What do I
assessing
want to
my
see?
own business.
Yeah. And like what? That's spot on. I shouldn't have interrupted. You were on something, but I was going to say what you said is something I want to make sure we capture. What I want to see it, right? Like you're saying the thing that I think a lot of organizations are forgetting about, and that is you should be checking all of your systems on a basis that's more frequent than once a year. And I would argue that somewhere between a week and a quarter is going to be based on systems. They may vary. Like I'm not looking like, hey, you should do everything every day. But we have tools now that allow us to do continuous vulnerability scanning. We didn't have that before, man. You were like, dude, I'm gonna run this scan. So like, don't try to like run any big jobs on your computer because the scan is gonna literally take all the resources that we have, and the internet's gonna be non-existent for like the next hour and a half.
Right. Yeah, it is. I mean, literally, that's how it is. So taking an assessment mindset and building some things into your routine. Look, there are some safeguards that we look at way more frequently than others. They're part of a weekly meeting that we have within our organization that we're like, okay, these KPIs that we're looking at to make sure that these things are happening are correct. Whether it's a score that a particular product gives us on the vulnerability scanning and where
Yeah.
we're at on the remediation plan and things of that nature. So it's really just kind of reviewing the things that we have in place, and then the places where we don't have something in place, then saying, okay, well, those we're going to have to take a little bit, whether it's monthly or quarterly or whatever, and have them more on a schedule. And so we have a checklist that that we have to get through
A
every
checklist.
month.
No
Yeah,
checklist. I'm just kidding.
checklist that we have to get through every month regarding various areas that we are just verifying that the things that we've put in place are continuing to work. And the cool thing is, if we do that and we find things that are broken, and we go
Yeah.
in and fix them, and
And
so and they're not
they just
broken
don't
for
run
very long.
perfectly forever.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we often miss. I mean, the age-old rule of nah, we'll just let it patch it on the next cycle.
Yeah, I mean, you can get
I
away
can
with that
imagine.
on some things, but it's really not the way that you should look at.
But if you have a process, right, is kind of your point, right? Like I guess I was maybe a little bit over simplifying it. Yeah, if it doesn't patch and it catches it the next time. But I think if you go back in time, I mean, largely we would say, oh, it'll catch the next time. Well, how many times before we proactively go in and investigate? Like, is that documented? Is there a, if any endpoint, goes through three patch cycles or two patch, whatever it is, what's the protocol? And I think it's some of these little things that you've described as part of your process. Maybe we don't call them little things, but I mean, the reality is they all add up to making a resilient environment. And I think that's ultimately the goal here. You didn't start out on a journey, but like, I just want to do SOC 2 just because it was there. We don't know what we don't know. And one of the things that you find out when you go through the trust mark is to do a gap analysis. What are the things that I know I'm doing? What are the things that I know I'm not doing? And what are the things I just genuinely don't understand? And hopefully that comes out with somewhere between a 60-40, 70-30. And it can be either direction. I'm not proposing that everybody's going to be, 70-80% deployed, but like you have to know where you are to know where you can go.
Yep, absolutely. And understand that it's never gonna really stop, because either A, I mean, look, the our realm changes so quickly now. I mean, you used to be, it's like, oh, well, we've got a
What realm are
year,
we in?
Oh man, just
Zelda? You're not wrong. Like we, but so yeah, that's a good point. The realm, the world that we live in today, or the realm we live in, depending on what kingdom you're from, you may find that your clients don't deal with some of the things that you are because your clients aren't all in the same vertical or the same industry or targeted by the same, geographic threat actor, whatever, fill in the blank. So Yeah, that's a good point. Like it's always changing. Yeah, and I think we've actually covered evidence quite well. I think it's we're not telling you what the evidence needs to look like. I think that's up to you as you go through your own process. Jim, what else would you leave our listeners with who are currently, whether they're going after the trust mark or any other framework for their own satisfaction, or they haven't even gone down that path? You know, how would you advise someone as a solution provider, like, hey, what are some of the things you should do first? We're going to assume that you are working towards or have worked through from a business operations standpoint, service delivery standpoint, and now you're trying to enhance your cybersecurity posture. We'll give them that win, and just I don't want to say assume because we know what that means, but that they are doing some of those things because I think our listeners are at that level or better.
I think so. And I think from my standpoint, really is just you've gotta like when you're digging a hole or you're planting a garden, you gotta stick the shovel into the ground, right? Okay. You've gotta get started. And like digging a garden or planting a tree or something like that, I mean it's gonna make you sweat a little bit. It's
Yeah.
gonna hurt working out. We were
Yeah.
talking about that
Yeah.
before we got on the call. It's like, I mean it's gonna be hard. It's
Yeah.
gonna be hard, but it does get easier. And as you realize that, look, I can do this. There are things that I can put in place, and I'm identifying those things as I'm going along, that
Yeah.
as I start going back and taking it from the beginning again, that the next time is going to be easier. And then the next time is going to be easier after that.
It's
And
like if you wait to weed the garden until it's overgrown with weeds, it's going to be backbreaking work. But if you maintain it from the beginning, it can actually be, for some people, enjoyable. I think that's a good way to describe it. I would also add to that, especially with cybersecurity, you don't need to do it all at once. As Mike Stewart says, any forward progress is good progress. And I think that's true. Like you have to start somewhere. Don't try to boil the ocean. Don't try to get all done in one day. It's not going to happen. Don't chat GPT all your policies because then you'll have policies you can't follow. I think that pretty much sums it up. For those of you listening, this has been an episode of MSP 1337. Thanks and have a great week.
Welcome to MSP 1337. I'm your host, Chris Johnson, a show dedicated to cybersecurity challenges, solutions, a journey together, not alone.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of MSP 1337. I'm joined this week by Parander Das with Zotero. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time out for our audience. So one of the things that we always want to do is anytime we have a guest, especially someone that hasn't been on the show before, is if you could just tell the audience a little bit about yourself, kind of your path to where you are today. I would love to hear you talk a little bit about Zotero. I'm very interested in what you guys are doing over there. And then we'll jump into your topic and I'll let you share that with the audience.
Sounds good, Chris. Thank you. As you said, I'm Parander Das. I'm co-founder and CEO of Zotero. We are a Boston-based startup, and I like to tell people that we are broadly in the cybersecurity space, but more specifically focused on data security. Obviously, the question is, how did I get here, right? Or how did we get here? The bulk of my career has been in marketing and marketing technology. I have been the CTO at two of the largest marketing services providers in this country, and one of them is actually one of the largest in the planet. What that did for me was expose me to two things. One was data management at scale. When you talk about building marketing solutions for the largest brands in the country or in the world, we're talking about tens of billions of transactions or records, right, that store sensitive information. The flip side of that is, how do you collect, store, but protect this information while the company is using them to drive their marketing, their customer relationship building? When you put those two things together, we're talking about data security and privacy management at massive volumes. that challenge is what got me and my co-founder started in the data security space, because what we saw was limitations around how to achieve security and privacy at scale that was meaningful, but didn't become an obstacle to enabling companies to operate and access the data. So we kind of looked
send
at
it
this.
Anyways, right? They're going to send the data either.
Exactly. Way. Yeah. But with all the regulations coming on board, and the administration, privacy groups becoming more stringent and focused on how to protect the consumer, addressing the challenge was what got us started. And we said, hey, there's got to be a better way of doing this. The classic, we need to figure out a better way of achieving data security and privacy. That's what got us started on this thing. So we looked at this problem as Zotero and said, most security, if not all of security, is focused on the outside in, meaning locked on the network, locked on access, which kind of is ironic because the one thing it didn't really protect was the data or the information itself. We said, why don't we look at it as an inside out problem and come up with a solution for facilitating this process. And we kind of came up with a patented ability to query encrypted attributes without the need to decrypt them. Right. So kind of sounds very technical and complex, but if you think about it, what it does is elevate data protection from at rest, meaning protect it when nobody's using it, to protect the data while it's being used. So that was our initial foray into this space.
So, I mean, we could just go so many different directions with this, but I think the one that pops out at me, I think about it, and you're going to have to tell the audience what this topic is, but I'm going to throw this out there. I think one of the challenges that we have in protecting data is so many people have become almost desensitized to what is sensitive data. Like they understand what data is. They understand when, you know, like a medical record should probably be protected, but we still see it all the time. Like, sign this document, put your social security number on it, and then scan and email it back to me. And you're like, well, how do I ensure that I'm sending you something that is going to get there securely, let alone like, why do I, like, so many steps are being taken to do something that should not be happening anymore. You shouldn't have to send this stuff around like this.
Yeah, right. Hey, absolutely. Right. I mean, the hacker aspect of it, or the data, the theft aspect of it, has become extremely complex because the talent and the skills being deployed on that side matches the talent and the skills on the traditional product development or the data management space, right? So no, it's not just, it's one data asset that has your credit card numbers. Sure. They are collating data from a broad base of sources that actually makes that hack or that attack or that criminal attempt so much more sophisticated, where they're actually crafting programs built around the ability to link your data, not just your credit card number, but potentially your medical history, your travel history, and all of this, and build a hack attempt that's so much more sophisticated that it continues to fool people. But it's all based around the fact that they have access to data.
And they're building a profile. So they're not just saying like, hey, I got your credit card number. They're not, they're like, hey, yeah, that's a win. We would have said that's a win. If I was a bad guy, having someone's credit card number without them knowing about it, that's at least a win, right? Because I can do something with that. But to your point, we're talking about like, that's just part of the breadcrumb trail that they're using to build something that allows for a much larger impact when they finally do deploy their.
Exactly. And even the monetization of that, right? There's the whole data collation aspect of it, then the sales aspect of it, then the people that are building platforms to leverage those things, providing people code, or even the phishing code, which is the starting point.
It is,
but it is reality. That's what we're facing, right? I mean, every day, what's the thing that that's consistent every day when you listen to the news or read the news? It's about new hack attempts or new breaches that have occurred.
I think the ones that are worse than the actual breaches to me right now is the doom and gloom of what's going to happen if we don't do something. But then no one says, what should we do? They just kind of leave it out there like, yep, if we don't protect critical infrastructure, you know, bad things are going to happen. It's like, that's probably true. So what's your suggestion, right? Like, give me something to do, and then I can at least take action. Let me be tactical.
So that's where we kind of looked at this and said, hey, this like a multitude of point solutions, right? Network access management, endpoint monitoring, log monitoring. If you look at this, the one thing that still is not protected is the data. And that's really an operational challenge because no company wants to introduce a data product because they're under the belief that it slows down commerce or process. The moment there's friction in the process, companies are scared because that means an impact on the revenue. And they go like, oh, we're not going to do anything at the data level because that's going to slow things down. We said, whatever we come up with has to operate at the speed of business, meaning no impact on the no impact on the business process or don't create any additional friction so that the business can continue to function, but still be able to provide this level of security and protection that data truly needs, which is one perspective. The second perspective is you can look at it as the ultimate backstop. If everything else fails, your endpoint monitoring fails, they find a new API or a vehicle, a third-party software vehicle that they piggyback on, you want to be able to protect your data in the event something bad happens. We took that approach as an inside-out requirement, and that's what we've done is provide a layer of protection at the data asset level. Very simply, if you think about all the things that happen at the network level, we achieve all of those at the data level with no impact to business. That's what we do.
So since you didn't tell him, I'm going to say that today's topic is all about protecting your data. Is that a fair...
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, it's all about protecting your data. What can you do to keep your data protected without impacting your business? And that kind of goes into, as you said, it can go in a multitude of directions, right? There is not one single data asset, right?
No, and I think we struggle with that a lot, right? I think you look at anybody that's been in business for more than a few years, you suddenly go, do you know where all your data is? And of course, their question is like, yeah, it's all on the server. And it's like, well, what about the data you sent to other people? What about the data you shared with? Fill in the blank. What about? And all of a sudden they're like, okay, it's in a few places. It's like, well, are you on any social media platforms? Do you, you know, like the information's out there and it's probably everywhere. Like, do you want to know? And then maybe knowing where it is less important than knowing how to protect it where it is. I think it would probably be a more comfortable feeling than just saying, I don't necessarily care it's there. I just care that it's protected.
There, yeah. Which you actually bring up a good point, right? That's also a multifaceted or a two-dimensional issue, right? Knowing where the data is and knowing what form the data is in, because you have databases, you have file stores, you have cloud stores, you have small data assets or repositories that think about. So there's the discovery aspect of it and providing a single platform for protecting data in all of its forms everywhere, all the time. If you look at our tagline, which is a plug here, but it's also relevant. We say we protect data everywhere all the time.
That raises a question back to what you said earlier about how threat actors are, they're not just getting a credit card and that's it and they're done. It's all the other pieces. And I think this is an interesting, made me think, like, if I think about data and I think about the different types of data, not all data is equal, right? So I'm thinking like, okay, yeah. Credit card, that's kind of a big deal. What if it's like I drive a blue charger? Well, there's lots of blue chargers, but blue charger is a data type that is attached to my car, but it's not really that important until you start using that to build that bigger package.
Because exactly.
Now you've pieced together information about me. And, you know, we were talking about this before the show, like, you know, when you can get access to that information very rapidly. And I think that's why I think we're seeing this new explosion of the doom and gloom of why things like critical infrastructure are suddenly being talked about in the news and the potential for bad things to happen is because of the way in which they're collecting the information to create the attack. It's not just little, it's all of the little things adding up to a big problem.
Exactly. I mean, it's a question of like, how does security and privacy keep up with innovation, right? Companies, organizations are focused on commercialization or bringing to market new products that drive new revenue. And I kind of cite this all the time. A simple thing like a sprinkler controller, right? We're all excited because that minimizes your water bill, kind of gives you control. We can turn it on, turn it off from wherever. But think about the potential data that a small device like that could be collecting, right? It could essentially predict your routine. It could tell them when they think you're going to be at home, when they think it's going to get It's going to be vulnerable. You attach that to the fact that you drive a car. It gives you a level of credibility when somebody has a conversation with you and says, hey, I know the charger that you drive, right? It kind of makes you more amenable to start giving them more information than you would if the context wasn't there.
Yeah. I don't want to say IoT is bad. It's not inherently bad, but I think about devices like a thermostat or, to your point, the sprinkler system. And you start piecing those together and all of a sudden I know an awful lot about your patterns. Like, you know, you watch the movies and they're like, someone gets kidnapped because they've been following them for weeks. They know they make the same path in the same coffee shop, the same, you know, every time. Well, what if it's not, it doesn't require any sort of physical tracking. We just are literally taking the data bytes that are coming in and saying, oh, we know that they leave the house every day at this time because that's when the lock gets turned on. We know, and we can see through the Ring cameras that no one's home when that happens. Like, suddenly you've built out a pretty extensive and you haven't done anything or gone anywhere.
Yeah, and so that to that point, right? I mean, the company that's selling that information doesn't realize the value or the potential challenge that it's going to raise, right? Because they're selling it to monetize it to another business that says, hey, sure, I'm going to leverage this data to sell them more services and you get a cut of the revenue. Fine, ship them the data, right? Somebody that gets their hands on that data set collates it with someone else, something else, and then immediately, like you said, be able to develop a profile that essentially tells them what you do when you do it and when you're vulnerable.
And I kind of think about, like, if we want to take this to scale, this is not really about, say, attacking an individual or a household or even residential, commercial, doesn't necessarily matter. But like, what if if you were to monitor that level of data set for an entire neighborhood or subdivision or a small city or a large city and start recognizing patterns with things like water consumption or electricity consumption, and then you can start going, well, if we can manipulate those things, then we can control the commerce happening for that city or that, you know, hey, we suddenly, cost of water just went through the roof. Why is everybody talking about a water shortage? Well, there isn't one. We're just talking about one. Make you think that it's happening so that people panic.
It's funny you bring that up because that's so relevant with this notion of the notion of charging price based on the demand, right? It's something, to your point, that with the data set and with the right analytics, you can create artificial demand and drive up prices. Absolutely.
Yeah, or at least create confusion in the market so that you don't rely on it anymore, and that can be just as bad too.
Wow. Yeah, and it's surge pricing. That's where this is. That's where this starts, right?
So going back in time, thinking about how we would have protected data, I remember I think it was the co-founder of Tenable on, and we were talking about security back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and how security was basically do what you're told. And if you get to do some security, that's better than no security. So yes, the marketing department says you're absolutely going to expose the folder to the public internet because otherwise you've created friction. Fast forward to today, obviously a lot of those problems are minimized. We tend to do some of those things better than before, but we've now also introduced things like AI and large language models that allow for that really fast data collection, that data, joining data sets together. In fact, in some cases, and I'd love your thoughts on this, on what data sets are talking to other data sets, right? Like, so you use an LLM and maybe whether it's ChatGPT, I'm not saying that just as an example, but like you use it and you're like, but what other data sets is it talking to that it should or shouldn't be using to help generate what it's going to give me back as an answer?
I think we're at the very, very starting point of data sets within LLMs, right? I mean, I think you mentioned that LLMs have been around for a while, or models have been around for a long time. What's given them the power is the available of computing, right? That's kind of became the foundation for collating and digesting, processing a massive amount of data, like, which was not even
fast.
Like, right? I mean, you couldn't even think that was possible a couple of years ago, and suddenly it's there, right? And that is kind of already started concerns about what's in there, right? Sure. In that data set that's already publicly available. As these evolve to drive more organizational specific needs, you're going to see the mingling of truly sensitive data about a consumer's interaction with the company, right? And that data with the behavior that they've exhibited in the broader open community. So think about all the conclusions and the inferences that can be drawn when you start mixing all this data together with the really no safeguards or no controls.
There's no rules. On how,
no rules, yeah.
Which also means that, you know, garbage in, garbage out. And if you don't have any control over the data sets, then you have literally no control over which ones are garbage and which ones are not as it puts data back into the output.
And unfortunately, in today's world, garbage out also has a massive impact and more, right. And quite usually a negative impact on the individual or the organization that's being referenced in that garbage output.
So we've really talked a lot about the negativity. Well, I shouldn't say negativity, the power of AI, the power of compute to get data, get answers. What we really haven't talked about is there a path forward that isn't just us speculating on, you know, if we were to do a better job protecting critical infrastructure, we'd be less worried about bad things happening to it.
So absolutely, there is certainly a path forward, right? And I mean, that's we're happy to be part of that thing. And we're not the only one. There's multiple sure. organizations trying to solve this problem. The first thing is keep data secure. I mean, stop the hackers or the criminals from accessing your data. That's the number one thing. And that relates to not just data, but it also relates to the infrastructure challenge, right? Making sure that they're secure. And making sure they're secure is preventing them from being contaminated, attacked, or being compromised, sure. right? That's a question of real-time monitoring, threat detection, and threat prevention, right? That involves real-time, massive, I won't say massive, but really quick detection of threats on even the smallest of devices, whether it's an IoT or thing, because they normally become the gateway for somebody getting into a network. Right?
So to rephrase what you just said, you're essentially saying we've got to monitor everything and act on the things that are out of yeah. the ordinary, which as you know, Sotero, you know, doing something like that. But you know, like you said, there's others. Do you think part of this is like getting organizations to recognize that you have to turn them on, you got to monitor. Like I think there's a lot of still not doing it. Like just not doing it at all, like, or they don't Absolutely. Know where their infrastructure is spread out. So they're monitoring one network, but they're not monitoring all the networks in their organization.
Monitoring, we can relate that to saying monitor all of the points of access to a network. Don't just focus on the laptops that you give out to your employees. There's a multitude of more entry points to your network that you're not thinking about, whether it's API gateways, third-party software that has access. It's not just the laptops and devices. And people say, we've done what we need to do for ransomware protection because we've got our endpoints protected. Your endpoints translates to usually the laptops. There's sure. a lot more, right? Monitor all of those in real time. From a vendor perspective, I think it's equally critical that vendors realize that creating a new software product that requires organizations to completely upgrade their environments for this to be effective is not a solution.
No, it's very cost prohibitive.
Yeah, and it's not practical or feasible to expect an organization to completely rip apart everything. So we've got to build something. We've got to build products and solutions that work in their existing environments.
And I think a good example of that would be like DICOM imaging systems in hospitals where, you know, they're running, you know, legacy operating systems, but the technology still works just like it did when they bought it. It's still doing what it's supposed to do, but the ability to secure it obviously is requiring things to change. We always called it compensating controls, but, you know, compensating controls can get extremely expensive too when that legacy, but to your point, you can't just go and uproot a $15 million solution just because the OS is antiquated in that model. I mean, it's just, you know, hospitals would be going out of business if they had every 3 to 5 years, they had to upgrade that.
Upgrade everything, right? I mean, I'll give you a more practical example. We talked to enterprises as part of our outreach, and we've had enterprises tell us, I mean, I obviously won't mention the name. These are multi-billion-dollar companies that say half of our processing is still done on mainframes. Does your product work on the mainframe? And absolutely. I mean, that's part of what we thought about because we come from the world where organizations use a lot of different technologies to achieve their business outcomes. And we're saying we understand that. And the product platform we build will always make sure that we work with everything that an organization has, and not expect you to either protect a portion of fraction of what you have, or say upgrade everything for it to be effective.
I mean, I will say this about, you know, some of the critical infrastructure stuff. I was listening to, I think it's the guys behind Run Zero. I think that's the company. He was talking about how, you know, like seeing something in critical infrastructure that's now connected to the internet. The only thing you can see is that I can make it do this or that, but I don't know what either of those things are, and I don't know what it is, but now I can see it. So now I can toggle this switch that opens a dam or closes a dam, but I have no idea. So in those cases, we're talking about like operational, you know, technology that's older than most of the IT or the IoT stuff that we use today. Like, you know, it was created before the idea of the internet 50 plus years ago. Do you think we need to upgrade that, or do we need to do a better job of providing better naming convention? It's like, I think that there are people out there that end up in having done something out of curiosity that causes bad things to happen, because I mean, we've seen kids get into systems and go, oh, this is cool. Click, no idea what click did. They just wanted to find out what would happen. Had it said this is this, you know, if it had a little bit more information to it, you know, the double-edged sword, I mean, I feel like sometimes we just don't have enough information at our fingertips to make better decisions, because what we are monitoring isn't telling us very much.
All right, so we spoke about the negative aspects of AI or LLMs. I mean, this is where that becomes so much more useful, right? It's going to be hard to come up with standard naming conventions and enforce them. That we're talking about a decade-long process, right? So
we got plenty of time.
Part of what we do for our discovery and classifications is leverage LLMs. Right, because they're so much more powerful in looking at the data asset and looking at the context and saying, hey, this is what this most likely is going to be, right? So there is certainly an opportunity to be able to do that at scale on a more reasonable time frame using technology to achieve where we need.
So now you're getting into making sure that LLMs are being built in such a way that they maintain the integrity.
Yeah. And I mean, so again, I mean, LLMs, it's not people kind of tend to focus on one aspect of LLM, right? Sure. I mean, if you think about the entire process end to end, it starts from data collection, data processing, data storage, data persistence, the cleansing and sanitization of a prompt, the sanitization of the output, validation that there's no copyright or sensitive confidential information in there, and then pushing that for consumption. So we're talking about an end-to-end a process, right? Like everything else. We are happy to say that we're up there early building that end-to-end platform that enables what we refer to as trusted interactions with LLM.
So you have to teach people to think differently, right? Because I think about... Like if I'm a great Python programmer, that doesn't mean I understand what's going to happen when, you know, you go in and log into your ChatGPT prompt and you start asking questions. It may not know how to process that, but you keep asking the questions and suddenly it's like, oh, that does make sense. I can totally give you an answer for that. Yes. And the reality is it shouldn't have given you, it should have been like alarms going off telling people like what is being asked is not okay for anybody to ask.
Exactly.
And if it's allowed to continue, well, now it's also corrupting the model.
The model, yeah. I mean, think about this. We've trained an entire generation of developers, right, and coders to not worry about security and privacy because everything was automated in the thing. It just became simpler where they said, I just need this answer. I'm going to get it. I'm not going to think about it. So in that context, you want to be able to make sure that all of this is automated, that they're operating within an environment that takes care of all of that. Because expecting every developer or coder out there to be cognizant and aware of this is not practical.
Yeah, but you remember if you go back in time to the days when we used like, you know, C# and C++ and you wrote it wrong and it caused the computer to crash when you went to compile it. Like, they don't have that. That doesn't happen anymore, right? Like,
exactly.
You might slow down. You might actually use something that's like, wow, this is taking really a long time to give me the answer that I'm looking for. But you don't see a reboot. You don't see a...
Yeah, computers don't crash anymore.
No, not like that. And we're using computers on scale. So 10 computers can fail and the other 90 are still up and running.
Up and running and generating either the wrong or the or a potentially dangerous output.
So we have just a few minutes left. We've talked a lot about, you know, how we should go about doing this, I think, differently than what many of us have. And I can tell you, I've got doing a workshop for a group this month on what, how to approach AI, how to approach the risks of AI. And like one of them is like, you know, what are the questions that you ask when you work with any vendor? Like, you know, one question would be like, just because the vendor doesn't tout that they're an AI company, like ChatGPT, Open, like we know those are AI companies, like that's what their model is, that's their business. But like we could say, you know, if you said Microsoft, you don't automatically say Microsoft and AI in the same statement. But the idea here is like with risk profiling and things along those lines, you might ask questions like, do you use AI in your products? Do you use AI and how does it interact with fill in the blank? What data of mine are you storing? Give me some ideas or some suggestions. Maybe you've got something to share that would help.
Yeah, I think there's a few basic questions you ask yourself, right? If I'm going to interact with an LLM model, what is my objective? Am I just trying to get a general or a generic response from the data that already exists there, right? If that's the thing, that's one thing. Then am I worried when I do that I'm going to potentially extract and consume copyrighted or confidential information that could put me in legal jeopardy because I inadvertently consumed?
That first one is like if I was asking about like the FAQ, like it could be a knowledge base.
Yeah.
And I'm asking questions much, and it's going to be much more, results will be much better than it just trying to search the text phrase in a database, right?
In the database, yeah.
Using its engine to, yeah. Okay, so then the second one you're talking about, you know, making sure that when you are using these prompts to understand where it's potentially pulling data from so that you don't get in legal jeopardy.
In legal jeopardy. Like, for example, you ask for some images, it gives you a copyrighted image from somebody that you're not aware of, you use it, hey, guess what? You just potentially violated a copyright that you were not even aware of, right?
So that's like similar to what we just saw recently with the New York Times, where we had a chat or a language model that literally went behind their gate, scraped all of that data. And of course now, you know, and every right to be upset.
Yeah, which I mean, they have, like to your point, they have a right to be upset because they've spent millions of dollars paying and sourcing this information that now anybody can consume, right?
Well, and not only that, but we're consuming it without knowing where it came from either.
Where
like, it's
came
not
from.
Like it says at the bottom, New York Times, copyright. Like,
yeah. The third aspect of it is potentially saying, okay, now that's fine for the generic or the publicly available information.
Sure.
What do I need to do if I need to leverage LLMs for driving a business process or optimizing a business process within me? Does that include exposing my sensitive data? How do I prevent my sensitive data or confidential information from being integrated with the open source information or the publicly available information?
We see this a lot with like in the IP space where you're like, maybe you're building software, you ask a chat prompt for help, you're struggling with, you know, getting your code's not working right. And then of course, suddenly it works great. And you're like, okay, but then what happened to what you put in there? Now has that entire, you know, piece of code, heaven forbid it get into the wrong hands. Like, I don't even mean about your software, but like just being able to use that to come after your consumers in the future, because now I've got this piece of code. I understand how you're writing software.
Yeah. You throw in all your data assets in there to generate some kind of a report or output. Guess what? All of that's in there. Right.
So this really gets into, what does it mean to say have private LLMs that you can leverage for the compute function? In a lot of cases, if you're a big organization, you don't necessarily need it to go check with the rest of the world and the LLMs that might be out there. You need it to just compute what you have.
Yeah. And so that leads to the fourth issue here, right? Which is bias and skewness in data. How good is your data to give you an accurate, statistically valid answer, right? If you throw all the data in there, have it train your model, right, the proprietary model for you, that doesn't mean that the data set is clean from a bias perspective.
Yeah, the two truths. We saw this in Times and Newsweek where you show the bar chart or a pie chart and by the percentage are so close, but they made it look really big. So when it's blown up in scale, it looks like it's way different.
Yep. And just because you're prior practices have resulted in you skewing your interactions towards a specific audience segment, that doesn't mean that you want to do it in the future. But if you rely on your data, that's where you're going to end up. So there's a statistics aspect of it that also needs to be implemented while you're training or preparing data sets to make sure that at least that you're aware that there's a bias in the data so you can account for it or be cognizant that your data is biased.
To some degree, it's kind of like saying you have to do maintenance just like you would on a car. Like you can't just let the data just continue to evolve on its own without somebody doing an integrity check periodically.
Exactly. And what's a good data set for one organization or for one objective is not necessarily a good data set for another.
Sure. Sure. And in fact, one wouldn't necessarily know unless they understand what's actually in the makeup of that data set too. Very easy to get excited about it.
And so here's the biggest problem that underlies all of this stuff, right? Resources or skills needed to make this happen. You're taking what an organization has within it and saying, now we've got a new set of objectives, technologies, and capabilities. Can they adapt to it? Or do you go look for a platform that normalizes all of this, but puts this information in a consumable form in front of the people that are sitting there and saying, this is what the data says it is. Here's the potential bias in there. Here's the security problems. Here's how do you protect yourself. I think
what you just said is kind of our reality, right? Like how many people could make a great pie chart in an Excel spreadsheet yesterday? Now they have Copilot and they can make pie charts all day long.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean they should be making pie charts.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. This was great. You really opened my eyes to a few things on the risks of AI and LLMs and also the potential that it brings with it. So for those of you listening, this has been an episode of MSP 1337. Thanks and have a great week.